Thank you, Nils, for your kind introduction. I've wondered several times during the course of this week whether it was wise to find myself in the final slot presenting something which is essentially a policy paper. And it may seem to you that this is a rather dry and dull way to finish what has been such an engaging and stimulating conference. However, I want to re-present to you the nature of this session and to dispel any misconceptions you might have had about it. This is, in a sense, a story of an example of the way in which the kinds of things we've been discussing this week can make a difference in practice. Now, of course, each of you will go home, I will go home, and I expect, I hope, that what we have engaged with here will transform our own practice. But more importantly than that, we have to transform the practice of others. If it's only our own working lives, professional lives that are changed, then that will simply not be enough. And colleagues were, with a group of colleagues at the Royal College of Psychiatrists, I was engaged for a number of years with struggling over this problem. We know that we think spirituality is important in the clinical practice of psychiatry. We know that it affects the way that we do our jobs. We know it's important to our patients. But how can we persuade our colleagues of this? I forget the current figures, but there are something like 18,000 psychiatrists who are members of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, most of them practicing in the United Kingdom, some of them practicing abroad. And we have 2,000, well now 4,000 members of the Spirituality Interest Group, so that's good, but that leaves 14,000 people who apparently haven't understood how this might be important in their clinical practice. So this is the story, if you like, of how we went about trying to change things, and mindful that this is being recorded and will be available on the web for my colleagues in England to listen to, I will be suitably diplomatic about how I tell the story, but you'll gather that it was not uncontroversial, that this was not an easy ride for us, that we were given a hard time by those who thought that everything that we've been talking about for the last 3 days was at best misguided and at worst positively unprofessional. There are folks like that in the UK. I'm sorry if that's a shock. I can see one or two worried faces, but there are psychiatrists in the UK, and I think in other countries too, who think that this is a seriously bad idea that we're engaged with here. Just see if I can get the technology on my side. Yes, good. So, I'm telling the story of how this document came to be. This is the one that was published in summer 2011. We had a minor update last year. So, if you want to go onto the Royal College of Psychiatrists website, look at the publications pages, you'll find this under the list of policy papers. It's a position statement. So, this is a formal piece of Royal College of Psychiatry policy. It has not exactly legal power, but it's an official paper which recommends to psychiatrists practicing in the UK how they should think about spirituality and religion in relation to their clinical practice. If you were blatantly to flout the recommendations in this paper, you would have to defend yourself quite vigorously. You would have to justify why you had gone against a substantial body of opinion expressed in a policy of the college in this way. And if you read the paper, you'll see that it's broken down into these sections. There's a bit on background and definitions, something on the evidence base, a reference to clinical practice and training, and then some conclusions and the final recommendations themselves, which are fairly short. This started off when I drafted the first version. I think it was a page and a half of A4. It ended up around about a dozen pages of A4, which in itself tells you something of the story of getting a paper like this through the necessary process. But I want to say a bit about the background, because the background is terribly important. For those of you who come from across the pond, not the Mediterranean, but the Atlantic pond, this is old hat. 20 years ago, you had the American Psychiatric Association had a policy statement on what they called guidelines regarding possible conflict between psychiatrists' religious commitments and psychiatric practice. These are just the two headline paragraphs, but it was a relatively short document. It's about a page of A4, I think. And it said some fairly basic but very important things about not using a professional position as a psychiatrist to proselytize, for example, being respectful of patients' beliefs and views, spiritual, religious, and otherwise. You may think this is terribly obvious, but if it isn't said somewhere officially, it's not terribly obvious to everyone. And there is reason to believe that not all clinicians have respected these guidelines, certainly not before they were published, and quite possibly not afterwards. So it does need to be said, and it needs to be said with the backing of a professional association. I suppose the debate really got going in earnest in the United Kingdom following an invited editorial by Harold Koenig in one of our Royal College's journals, Psychiatric Bulletin. It's changed its names a couple of times since then, which is confusing, but essentially the correspondence all took place in this periodical, which is a publication of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. So most UK psychiatrists will receive a copy of this through the letterbox, and they'll at least browse it, if not read it assiduously. And Harold was invited to write the editorial under the heading Religion and Mental Health, What Should Psychiatrists Do? This is back in 2008, so this is 6 years ago now. And in summary, I'm glad Harold's not here, apologies to him for grossly over abbreviating his paper, but in summary he suggested some pretty uncontroversial things. You should take a spiritual history. You should find out what your patient thinks about things spiritual and religious. If they have healthy religious beliefs, which are an important coping resource, you should affirm them. Maybe sometimes you'll encounter blatantly unhealthy beliefs, which raises the question of what they might be, but if they clearly are detrimental to spiritual, psychological, social well-being, they should be questioned. He raised the matter of praying with patients, which I think in the context from which he wrote in North Carolina was a very reasonable thing to do. He wasn't to realise how controversial that would be on our side of the Atlantic. And finally, he talked about consultation with, referral to, and joint working with trained clergy, particularly healthcare chaplains. Now, all of this had been said before, apart from perhaps the bit about praying with patients. We have the Prince of Wales as the patron of the Royal College of Psychiatrists. In his inaugural address to the college, he had talked about the importance of spiritual care. We've had successive presidents of the Royal College addressing the membership on the importance of spiritual and religious factors in clinical practice. So this was not new. It was not like British psychiatrists had not heard any of this before. Despite that, there was a flurry of outraged correspondence, almost all of it negative. It was alleged in the letters that followed electronically and in the printed copy of the journal that the interventions proposed breached professional boundaries. Spiritual history taking is intrusive, particularly for agnostics and atheists, apparently. It shows a lack of respect for non-believers. Judgments about which beliefs should be supported and which challenged are too value-laden, too difficult. The clinician shouldn't even attempt to get into that kind of territory. This sort of thing, it was said, opens the door to proselytizing. It's risky, it carries risk of harm to patients, particularly psychotic patients who might have delusional beliefs of a religious or spiritual nature. Praying with patients was particularly controversial. I won't go into that, but there was a lot said about that. And spirituality, it was alleged, is culture-bound. In contrast with the neutral secularity of society in the UK, which was esteemed and valued widely by these correspondents, all of whom thought it provided a safe space within which to talk about things spiritual and religious. I'd say in passing that that shows some naivety and perhaps some bias on the part of the correspondents. But anyway, that was the suggestion, that actually we need to keep safe space within which spirituality and religion are more or less excluded. Now, at the time of this correspondence, we had much less published guidance on these things than you might imagine. The document which governs the good clinical practice of psychiatrists in the UK is this one. It's called Good Psychiatric Practice. It does what it says on the tin. And inside, it says, a psychiatrist must provide care that does not discriminate and is sensitive to issues of gender, ethnicity, colour, culture, lifestyle beliefs, sexual orientation, age, and disability. So spiritual and religious matters are lumped in under the heading of belief, along with a lot of other areas in which there's a fear that discrimination could take place. And it says later, when negotiating the aims and outcomes of treatment plans, a psychiatrist must recognise and respect the diversity of patients' lifestyles, including cultural issues, religious and spiritual beliefs. That's the only sentence within which the words religious and spiritual, or derivatives thereof, appear in the document. So there was something there, but of course there's wide scope for interpreting that differently. There's lack of specific guidance about how that should look in practice. Now, the process that followed that publication, the debate that followed, was a prolonged and tedious one, but within the spirituality interest group, we were able to engage with the college committees which govern policy so as to establish that actually there was a willingness to look at a more detailed and comprehensive approach to addressing these concerns. And I won't say a lot more here about the process itself. I'm going to focus mainly on content, but suffice it to say, I found myself in a room at the Royal College with 50 or 60 colleagues against whom I had to defend what was being proposed, and there were probably at least 50 or 60 opinions in the room about the best way of going forward with this. So it was not easy. I had many who were supporting what was being proposed, but there were many who were against it. And a very vigorous debate took place over the succeeding months and years. What emerged is essentially what I'm going to present to you now, and I'll highlight along the way where the tension points were. And of course, one of the first things that we encountered is the need for a definition. Now, somehow, this didn't prove as controversial as I had thought it would. There was one person who wanted to dispense with religion completely and just talk about spirituality. But by and large, I think many members of the college didn't see much difference between spirituality and religion. And if they did, they weren't going to quarrel about exactly how we would define each of them. But the definition that was used in the document was one that I had published a number of years earlier, primarily in relation to the addictions literature, but really with a much broader view of how we could find a comprehensive statement of something that would be inclusive. Now, this is too wordy, it's not good for research, I realise it has many limitations, but we were seeking at that time to identify the main issues and to present them in a way that would not be offensive to anyone if we could possibly avoid it. So we wanted everyone to be able to look at this and say, yes, okay, that's spirituality, I can live with that. Or if I don't like spirituality, well, at least that's what I'm objecting to, and it's within this paragraph that I can find my cause for concern. I won't go through this phrase by phrase, because a lot has been said this week about definitions of spirituality. Just one thing perhaps is worth saying in passing. We did say here that it's a universal dimension of human experience. Staggeringly, no one questioned that. So I don't know whether that got through on the quiet, or whether we just got lucky because there were other things that people wanted to argue about, but it was essentially acknowledged that this is something that affects everyone. It's not just for the religious folks, it's not just for a few. This is something that affects all patients, all professionals. The other thing is that there's been much said this week about transcendence and spirituality. You'll see in here, and this is the theologian in me coming out, we didn't leave it at that. We said spirituality may be experienced as a relationship with that which is intimately inner and immanent, and or a relationship with the transcendent. So we were wanting to have our cake and eat it here. We wanted both. It's not just about transcendence, lest you imagine that spirituality is all about God, and if you don't believe in God, it's not relevant to you. Actually, a lot of spiritual practices today, particularly those that are relevant in the UK context, are very imminent in focus. Mindfulness as a spiritual practice is a focus on the present moment. It's an anchoring in the here and the now. It's an immanent practice. Much of what we call New Age spirituality, it's not a very good term, but for want of a better one, New Age spirituality focuses on the immanent, on the, I would say as a Christian, the created order of things. If you don't like the word creation, the reality of the world around us. So transcendence alone doesn't seem to do the trick. We felt that we had to bring in the tension, the paradox, that actually spirituality is both about the here and now and the above and beyond, and that actually we were encapsulating something much more complicated than theistic beliefs alone might imply. So anyway, whether it was right or wrong, this was the definition we used. And we said relatively little about religion because we were wanting to put the emphasis on spirituality, but we did acknowledge that religion is concerned with beliefs and practices that are important, with a relationship to the divine, usually, Buddhism of course is not, and with social institutions and communities, and that all of this is important too. What our colleagues really wanted us to get onto was not the controversy around theological and spiritual things, but the evidence base. And time and again, I had colleagues in the college saying to me, what about the evidence? Where's the science that backs up the importance of what you're talking about here? And we referred in a rather idiosyncratic way to a number of publications that seemed to do the job for us. One which had very fortunately been published around about the same time as this controversy, which was an attempt by a bunch of UK psychiatrists to show the relevance of the evidence base to clinical practice. This is really a book about clinical practice and spirituality in psychiatry, but we had enough reference to the evidence in there that we could use this and say, here, look, the college published this book, so the college has already acknowledged that there is an evidence base for what we're talking about. We also used Harold's doorstop handbook. Of course, it was the first edition at the time of the debate. We didn't have the second edition available to us then. But just really by way of flagging up the headlines, look, folks, this book alone critiques over 1,200 studies. Shows, generally speaking, you might debate this, but it shows, generally speaking, that religion appears to be associated with better health. It's actually a good thing, not a bad thing. Spiritual interventions sometimes seem to have good outcomes. And yes, we acknowledge that there's a debate about methodology and that more research is needed. But there is a discussion to be had. You can't ignore all of this literature. And of course, we referred to the growing... this colour doesn't work well on... works well on this screen, I can see it. You can't see the curve here. This is publications on spirituality and mental health as a percentage of the total Medline database published on an annual basis. So even if you allow for the fact that Medline is growing exponentially year on year and we've got more and more papers being published in the medical and scientific literature, actually as a proportion of that growing database, publications on spirituality are growing within it. So this is important. We can't ignore this as psychiatrists. We need to pay attention to it. But we did also have to acknowledge that there is a literature which argues against what we as a group of colleagues were fundamentally trying to say. Now, in the US, Richard Sloan's work is particularly widely cited, and indeed to some extent in the UK as well. Much less well known to all of you, perhaps, will be this character, Professor Rob Poole. Poole, who also plays the guitar in his spare time, is a professor of psychiatry in North Wales at Bangor University. Rob and I were at medical school together and used to argue about matters religious and related over coffee as medical students. And 30 years later, we're doing the same thing, but we now do it in print in published journals. So we're getting used to this. And in between savaging me in print, he can be very friendly and very cordial when we meet face to face. And somehow we manage to combine this sort of love-hate relationship with one another. But Rob, to be fair to him, Rob is vocal. He has a passion for defending his understanding of atheism and his approach to good practice. But he's not alone. He has many quieter colleagues who agree with him, who are co-signatories with him on his letters and publications. And he represents a body of opinion in the UK that says, this is all very well, but there are other ways of interpreting the evidence. And actually, some of us have serious concerns about whether what you're proposing is compatible with good medical practice. And at times, it has even pushed the limits of whether what we're proposing is acceptable within good medical practice as defined by the General Medical Council. Now, if you're breaching the guidance of the General Medical Council, you get struck off. You know, this is serious stuff. So you've got to take these questions seriously. The other thing, just before I finish this part of the talk, we pointed out that whether people like it or not, actually certain treatments are now becoming routine which are of a spiritual nature, and particularly we were thinking about mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and the way in which 12-step facilitation, for want of a better phrase, has become a part of work in the addictions field. And indeed, when Rob Poole and I have debated these things personally, he has confided in me, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this in a recording, in the difficulty of how one addresses the situation where a patient is getting obvious benefit from a 12-step program, which I think Rob would fairly say he doesn't agree with, he doesn't believe in, but he can see sometimes is beneficial to a patient. So how do you deal with that situation where your own evaluation of the evidence and of the value of spirituality is counter to that of your patient? How do you deal with that situation? So we were saying you can't brush this under the carpet, you can't ignore it. There are spiritually based practices out there which are already in use, and we need to know how to respond to our patients when they talk to us about them, when they're engaged with them. The other thing that was very influential with the college is that spiritual and religious attention to spiritual and religious issues in treatment seems to be something that mental health service users want. Now, we have much less research evidence on this in the UK than perhaps in some other countries, particularly in the US, but we do know from the work that's been done by the Mental Health Foundation and others that actually people say time and again, I want to be able to talk to my psychiatrist, my community psychiatric nurse, about the way in which all of this impacts upon my faith. I might be a spiritual person and not a religious person, and I want to be able to talk to my psychiatrist about those things without it being labelled as a part of the disease process. And again and again, particularly when I was chairing the spirituality group at the college, I had people coming to me and saying, I talked to my psychiatrist about how my faith is helping me, and he said, well, that's all part of the delusion. I can't discuss that with you. That's part of your illness. We'll talk about it when you're better, or something like that. So the college is concerned because the voice of service users these days is important. And if service users say, I can't talk about this and I want to be able to talk about this, they take it seriously. They take it seriously. So actually, it was at the end of the day, it might have been less the professional concerns about these things that got the matter onto the agenda than it was the patient's concerns. If patients want it addressed, it has to be addressed. Now, we had quite a bit on clinical practice in the final document, and this screen particularly is important because when I was defending this for the second or third time, the kind of conversation I was having and beginning to recognise as a familiar one was that colleagues were coming at me from different points of view, but they were saying, well, look, our patients have just as many different points of view as we do. And if you look in the, I think it was the Ethical and Professional Practice Subcommittee or something like that, there were a dozen or so people in the room. Some of them had similar views to me. Some of them were Christians, Jews, Buddhists, people from established faith traditions for whom their religious faith was important. Other people were saying, well, we don't do all of that, or we've borrowed bits of all of it, and we like the teachings of the Buddha, and we like what Jesus said, but we don't, you know, we don't buy the whole thing. They would be a bit sort of pick and mix about their religious beliefs, or they might say, I'm spiritual and I'm not religious. And other people were saying, why are we debating this again? We've spent hours discussing this. Can we get onto the important thing about atypical neuroleptic medication or something? And other people were saying, like my friend Rob Poole, this is really bad. We shouldn't be doing this. This is stuff that we shouldn't be addressing, at least not in this way. And how could we possibly accommodate this wide range of views that we were encountering professionally and that we knew were mirrored amongst our patients? And in the end, we decided that there were actually four groups. There were those who identified with a particular tradition. They usually call themselves Christians or Muslims or Jews. They know where they belong. There were those who adopt a personally defined or sometimes personal but undefined spirituality. So they can either tell you very specifically what they believe and it's not religious, or they say, well, I am spiritual and not religious. I'm not quite sure what I mean by that, but it's very important to me, that kind of thing. So we were including them in this second bullet point here. And then we had the other two groups, the ones who were disinterested, said it wasn't important, and the ones who were antagonistic, who felt that this was something that was unprofessional, potentially unprofessional. So we acknowledged that we had to respect those points of view amongst ourselves, but that also when we walked into a consulting room and we had a new patient in front of us, we wouldn't know where they were coming from. The person you've not met before could be any of those. Okay. I don't think there's any other group. If you think of one, let me know. But we think that covers every possibility. But in advance of the meeting, you don't know which of those you're encountering next. And you have to show by your opening comments, by your initial questioning, by your screening process, that you're respectful of that person, whichever of them they might belong to. So if they're disinterested or antagonistic, opening up with a question about, well, spiritual and religious beliefs are very important, and, you know, we clearly want to know what you think about these things, would be disrespectful. It would be unhelpful, because you're giving a message that says, actually, you're wrong. You know, this isn't important to you, but I think it's important, and I'm going to impose it in this clinical interview. So we were trying to avoid those potential clashes that might result in alienation of a patient or giving across a message of disrespect, which we didn't intend. Now, the other thing we had to attend to was good medical practice. This is the GMC guidance, which really is, as I said earlier, serious stuff. It's enshrined mainly in this document, which covers the basics of good practice for all physicians in the UK. And then there's supplementary guidance under this heading, personal beliefs and medical practice. And that goes into a bit more detail. Fortunately or unfortunately for us, shortly after our initial policy document was published, all of this changed, and we had to make some minor changes in our policy in order to accommodate the new guidance. But at the time that we were having this debate, the key things were things like this. I'm not covering everything that's in the document, but the GMC say you must not express to your patients your personal beliefs, including political, religious or moral beliefs, in ways that exploit their vulnerability or that are likely to cause them distress. So one of the things the General Medical Council are concerned about is that you don't go in and say, well, I'm a Christian, and so blah, 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 blah. Now, I've heard others on this platform in the week say that maybe you should be telling people where you're coming from, because it's helpful for them to know that. But the danger that the GMC are worried about is that you're promoting your faith viewpoint and prioritising that in some way that's detrimental to the patient. Actually, the new version of the GMC guidance, which came out after we'd finished our document, is much more negative than this. The current wording now makes it quite difficult for a UK physician, UK doctor, to talk to the patient about their own faith unless there's a particularly good reason for doing so. For example, the patient says to you, "What do you believe, doctor? You know, what do you think?" And I've had that happen, and patients do that for particularly interesting and important reasons, and gets complicated at that point. But if they don't do that, you really shouldn't be talking to them about it, according to the GMC. This is much longer, and we don't want to go through all of this, but the key bits at the top. Trust and good communication are essential components of the doctor-patient relationship. And there is an acknowledgement that sometimes that process of trust and communication means you talk to the patient about what they believe, spiritually, religiously. So at least that's acknowledged. And there is still space for doing that, although actually the new guidance is less affirming than this document was. So we were fortunate we had this at the time. You can skip that. So that's where we were starting from. What series of short recommendations could we make that would address that context, that would comply with existing guidance from the General Medical Council and others, and which would address the concerns that colleagues from a wide variety of different viewpoints were proposing to us? I said to you, I started out with a very short series of punchy statements, and by the time they'd been through a few committees with additions and extra clauses and qualifications, it all ended up much longer than I would have liked. But here we have the first recommendation, which in many ways is the most important, and I won't go through all of them in detail, but it is important to stop and pause on this one. We ended up with this: a tactful and sensitive exploration of patients' religious beliefs and spirituality should routinely be considered and will sometimes be an essential component of clinical assessment. Now, all of these recommendations, to some extent or another, are a compromise, because we were addressing just such a wide range of different professional perspectives on this. You can guess where the additional clauses inserted themselves in what I had originally said very simply: you should be taking a spiritual history or something to that effect. We had to end up with should routinely be considered. Okay. They can't stop you from thinking about things, and we were suggesting that you should always be thinking about this. Always doing it was just too much to take. And to be fair, the point was made that sometimes you do have very short clinical consultations. As Harold Koenig was saying the other day, 15, 20 minutes to review medication. You can't always be going through the stuff about spirituality and religion again. So you've always got it in the back of your mind as being important, but you won't always be able to actually implement it in the assessment. And we did manage to get in that sometimes this is an essential component of clinical assessment. I felt really pleased with that. It may feel a bit watered down. I don't know how it comes across to you. I've read this and reread it so many times I've lost track of reality. But the fact that sometimes it's essential and that we could all agree on that, I think is a real achievement. So the point has been made that you may not always want to talk about this with your patients, but sometimes it will be so important for the patient, perhaps more than for you, that it has got to be discussed. And that sets the premise for everything else. That means you've got to be ready for that conversation. It means you've got to know a little bit about the subject and how you're going to handle the issues that might come up. So we were pleased with that. This really is something I've already spoken to you about. This is about the need for respecting the spiritual and religious beliefs and practices of patients and families and carers, and that this should enable them and allow them to continue the practice of their faith tradition if they want to do so while they're under your care. I think, again, this may be more significant than appears, but I remember not so many years ago on a ward round one of my psychologist colleagues saying, in reference to a Catholic patient who was suffering from an affective disorder and profoundly guilty, my colleague said, well, of course, if only she gave up her Catholic faith, she'd be fine. Fortunately, he said that to the group of professionals rather than to her. But you could tell that that was going to influence his approach to working with her. And we're now saying clearly, actually, that's not acceptable. Psychiatrists should not use their professional position for proselytising and undermining faith, and we managed to say, and appropriate professional boundaries should be maintained. We had a lot of debate about the fact that actually proselytising isn't just about, the wording here doesn't necessarily convey this, but proselytising isn't necessarily the religious professional imposing faith upon an unbelieving patient. Actually, it can be the atheist professional imposing disbelief upon the believing patient. And it was acknowledged more widely in the document that that was important too. Psychiatrists should work to develop appropriate organisational policies which promote equality, understanding, respect and good practice in relation to spirituality and religion. So what we were looking at here is the way in which the psychiatrist as a member of the health service delivery organisation, whatever that might be in your country, I mean in our case it's almost always NHS trusts. Sometimes of course it might be a private healthcare provider or a charitable organisation of a different kind. But usually we're thinking here about psychiatrists working within the National Health Service who have the opportunity to establish organisational policies that will promote and facilitate the kind of clinical practice that we were encouraging. And we recognise that some very good clinicians are actually frustrated from being able to implement good practice because the organisation hasn't acknowledged the importance of it and doesn't give it space within set procedures and practice guidelines. Psychiatrists, whatever their personal beliefs, should be willing to work with leaders and members of faith communities, chaplains and pastoral workers in support of the well-being of their patients, and should encourage other members of the team to do likewise. So we were reaffirming that this is not you on your own. You get in touch with the local pastor, with the priest, with the chaplain, whoever's appropriate in a particular case, and you work alongside them, and you use them as a resource to help you better understand the way in which spirituality and faith impact upon your patient. We're nearly there, there are only seven of these. Psychiatrists should always respect and be sensitive to spiritual and religious beliefs or lack of them among their colleagues. We put this in as a separate recommendation in the end. It was originally, I think, paired up with the similar bit about patients. But what we had to acknowledge was that actually talking to one another about these things was quite difficult too. Even if there wasn't a patient in the room, we had widely differing points of view. And we had to be respectful to one another as a model for how we wanted to respect our patients. And that was a part of the process, that actually this helped us to be better clinicians. And then finally, religion, spirituality and their relationship to diagnosis, etiology and treatment of psychiatric disorders should be considered an essential part of both psychiatric training and continuing professional development. I'm sure you've come across those little exercises where you may have a video of a road traffic accident or something like this, and you ask three or four witnesses what happened, and everyone has a different account. And it was interesting when we were discussing this and we raised this matter of training, how many different accounts there were of what psychiatric training looks like in the UK. Some of my colleagues said, we had really good teaching about spirituality and religion in clinical practice when I was a trainee. There's nothing needs to change. It's all great. It's been done very well. And other people would say, we didn't have anything at all. Maybe I missed that lecture, but nothing was said to me. And other people would be somewhere in between. Well, yes, we had something very short, but it wasn't done very well, and it was a bit boring, and I was left with the impression it wasn't very important. So again, we had this wide range of different attitudes and perspectives to what was actually taking place. And we have now established that it's an important part of initial training, of postgraduate training, but also of continuing professional development. And happily, since the publication of these guidelines, we've had at least one major event sponsored by the college, which was open to trainees and others, so that they could see that actually the Royal College of Psychiatrists is promoting good training, good practice, good teaching in this area. Spirituality and religion is on the agenda. We're having slightly, and we've also got an online CPD module, so if you're an established practitioner and you're wanting to update and get credits for your revalidation, you can log on, you can do the spirituality module online at the Royal College. We've had a little bit more difficulty getting it into the basic curriculum and into the examination framework. And to be honest, I have felt paranoid at times, but I don't think paranoia is due. It's just that the curriculum is now so full. It's such hard work getting new things added to it. There's so much debate about how we establish priorities that it's difficult to do almost anything. And while I'm saying spirituality and religion are important, other people are saying, well, actually basic psychology is important. They know nothing about cognitive theory or learning theory. We've got to get that onto the agenda. What about genetics? Genetics is terribly important these days. And all the new drugs, and by the time you've finished, you've got so much, you just can't move for new things. The curriculum when I was a lad, the curriculum when I was a lad was a very small document and about two or three pages of, you should know about the etiology of mental disorder, you should know how to treat common psychiatric conditions, this kind of thing. And now, well, at one stage it got up to about 150, 160 pages of complex tables with skills, attitudes, knowledge, practice, all these kinds of things. So it's getting very, very difficult now to see the priority of anything because the document is so long that no one ever sits down to read it from beginning to end. I just wanted to finish on a slightly, it's an advertisement I'm giving you at the end, but just to follow on from that point about training, because there's so much that can be done, so much that is being done in the UK and elsewhere about training, but we're conscious that it occurs within particular professional boundaries. And in case any of the story that I've told gives you the impression that we only think that it's important what the psychiatrist does, I want to assure you categorically that that is not the case. This was the story of how within a particular professional organisation we went about trying to establish a policy which would change practice. In fact, what I believe, what many of us believe, is that cross-professional working, interdisciplinary thinking about these things is terribly important. And if you'd like to come to Durham, England, don't get confused with Durham, North Carolina, which is also very nice, but very, very much warmer. We have now a master's program in spirituality, theology and health, which brings clergy and health professionals together, also people with theological and arts backgrounds, with people with health science backgrounds, to talk together, to work together in the classroom, looking at how these different ways of viewing human well-being inform and critique one another. So in a sense, we could go back to what John was saying in his talk about the different stories and the diagnostic story, but then the very different story of the person who says, well, I'm a Christian and I hear demonic voices speaking to me and it really makes me depressed because they say awful things. These two different stories, how do we bring them together? How do we engage them? How do we respond clinically and professionally to the dilemmas that they present us with? And this is what we're working on in Durham, and it's really exciting. It's great fun in the classroom, so do come and join us if you're able to do that. But that's the end of the presentation. I'm happy to receive any questions, and I gather there's plenty of time for that, so over to you.
Thank you. That was a very interesting presentation. And I wondered if the group had any discussion about cults. And I recognize sometimes there's a difficulty to distinguish cults from other organized religious groups.
Well done. You've spotted one of the things that we didn't get into the policy document. Because we identified things we could eventually reach an agreement on, which is good. It's a political process. You have to work with your colleagues and, you know, you have to agree. But there were some things which were just too difficult. One of them was praying with patience, and another one was how do you identify positively harmful, unhelpful, damaging spiritual and religious beliefs and practices. And we all acknowledge that this is important. We all, you know, none of us pretend that it isn't relevant, but how could we encapsulate this in a succinct form, in a policy document of this kind? We couldn't think of a way of doing it. And as we were having so much trouble with the other things, we thought we'd focus on, you know, what we could do rather than what we couldn't. At some point, we need to come back to that. The book that was published around about the same time, I mentioned Spirituality and Psychiatry, edited by myself. Incidentally, it wasn't a journal, Nils, it's an edited volume. But that book, Spirituality and Psychiatry, does have a chapter in it on what we call pathological spirituality. We had much debate about what to call it. But in the end, we used pathology because it's a word that doctors like, and it was a book primarily for doctors, so we thought they'd find this accessible. And it was our way of saying, you know, we're telling you that spirituality and religion are good things and that they help people to cope and that they're fulfilling and life-affirming, but we do acknowledge that sometimes they have the capacity to be the opposite of all of that. And exactly how we agree on the characteristics of that nasty kind of spirituality, I'm still not sure, but it needs more attention, much more.
Dr. Colin Weiser from Coventry University. I wonder what you think about the influence of Richard Dawkins is on psychiatry.
Very unhelpful.
Yeah.
Very unhelpful. You probably know my colleague Andrew Sims, past president of the Royal College, has written a response to Dawkins called Is Faith Delusion? And systematically demolishes Dawkins' rather fragile and superficial arguments about you know, the idea that religious belief is delusional. So I think, to be honest, a lot of psychiatrists would agree with that. And my friend and enemy, Professor Poole, actually doesn't much like Dawkins himself. He says that actually Dawkins presents such... I can't remember the words Rob used. These are my words rather than his. But you know, the gist of it, he presents such a caricature of an argument that actually it's implausible, and he feels very unhelpful to the debate. So it's many atheists who find his views not very useful, not just me.
Okay.
We value what you psychiatrists have done. Have you had much contact with the College of Physicians and General Practitioners and helping them to produce similar sort of statements?
No, I'd really like to do that. I suppose the trajectory of my career has been, I am still a member of the Royal College of Psychiatrists and I'm still an honorary consultant, as Neil said, but I'm doing less and less in the way of clinical practice, more and more in the way of engagement with spiritual care issues. So I'm drawing more on my role as a theologian and as a priest than I am in those domains. But we do acknowledge that the other colleges need to address this too. I think historically, for a variety of reasons, they've had less need to address this. Palliative care physicians, of course, perceive the importance. They're on board. They see that this has to be addressed. But a lot of the other groups are really way behind in...
Arjan Braam from Utrecht in the Netherlands. We are also considering a guideline, and I hope you will want to be willing to advise us. My question is, because nurses and other workers and also for outpatient care are so important in psychiatric treatment, what are the advantages or disadvantages in the UK for not considering a multidisciplinary guideline?
Oh, absolutely must consider the multidisciplinary context. At the same time that I was doing this, colleagues have been working within the nursing profession, for example, to express in various ways the importance of, I think they call it a policy document, but there are measures within nursing to affirm the importance of spiritual care.
Okay.
And so nurses have that flagged up. I mean, I've talked to my nursing colleagues about this, but of course it's their job to do that because I'm not a member of their professional bodies. At the same time, we're working on a local basis. So, for example, in northeast England, two of the mental health providers have been addressing this very seriously. We work together on a regular basis to look at how within the organisation we can encourage multi-professional working that addresses spiritual needs. And we do that with service users as well as from colleagues in all clinical disciplines and from management. And it's been a very, very interesting process. If anything, it's taken us even longer than the college process. We're still working on it. But it's been less controversial because at every meeting, there are two or three or four service users who are sitting there saying, this is really good that we're doing this. We really are grateful for your help. And then it's difficult for the professionals to not want to support them in that.
We have in Niels Christian Vita. We have in Denmark a museum with art by psychiatric patients. And one of my doctoral students came to the project he's on now, how religiosity is present in psychiatry. He came from that museum having seen all that, how much religiosity and spirituality was present in this art.
Yes.
So most people agree that psychiatric patients is a very religious population, one could say, in society, whereas psychiatrists very often come across as the opposite in the general public, at least. What is your opinion? I know you've published something on the so-called religiosity gap that was found in Australia, but it hasn't been found recently in Norway. And where are you at now? How does it look in the UK, for instance?
Well, there are others here who may be better placed than me with the current data, but yes, I did publish a paper on that, which was really arising out of the same work that I've just been presenting to you. And I didn't do any new empirical research, but colleagues have done that kind of work in the UK, not recently. And one of the major studies, for example, is amongst old age psychiatrists specifically, so not all psychiatrists. So there's a number of questions about whether we have a current picture of exactly what the religiosity gap looks like in the UK. But anecdotal evidence suggests there is one. We commonly have this problem. More commonly, the unreligious psychiatrist not understanding the religious patient. That's the dilemma that's presented. Sometimes it's the other way around. Some of my colleagues are not very sensitive in their expression of their spirituality and faith, or maybe patients misinterpret things that were said. I'm not prejudging the issue, but either way, there's this gap in the consulting room so that we're not communicating effectively. And this was why we introduced that sort of four-category analysis of the potential clashes that you can encounter. Because even if statistically we discover that there are more Christian psychiatrists than we thought in England, which I doubt, but if there were, the clash will still occur sometimes. It's only a statistical matter of how often it occurs. And more importantly, when it does occur, how well do you deal with it? And the point I was trying to make in the paper is that actually psychiatrists have said in the UK that, you know, they don't do religion. Actually, they do. They have, you know, psychiatry of a sort is a certain kind of religion.
Question?
Yes. Thanks, Professor Cole. In Australia, there have been a number of cases when doctors got reported to the medical council just for making some very casual comment. One case is actually a GP consulting with a young patient with chronic fatigue syndrome with a casual comment about the amulet that she was wearing. And at the end, I think he did receive a warning from the medical council, but not kind of suspended in any way. Have you observed any change in the incidence of medical, legal, or
disciplinary kind of incidents in relation to the publication of this particular recommendation, and do you think that that may have any impact on that at all?
Well, that's an interesting question. We've discovered that the figures in the UK are very difficult to get, at least for doctors. And we've been to the General Medical Council and discussed this with them, and there's just layer after layer of ethical, professional, statistical, you know, IT problems with accessing the data. It's all there on a huge computer in London, and in theory we could find out how often complaints are made about doctors on the basis of spiritual and religious matters and what the outcomes are, but we have no way at the moment of actually accessing that data and analysing it. We haven't given up. We're still working on the possibility, but it presents a whole series of really complicated problems. Yeah.